Today at Reader's Corner, national sports columnist Dan Wetzel, co-author of Death to the BCS, the definitive case against the Bowl Championship Series.
College football's postseason is outsourced to bowl directors, and it's the only American sport that does this. It's really the only business I can think of that would ever outsource its most profitable and important product. Why do we have the BCS? What's the real reason? It's not academics. It's not the sanctity of the Beef O'Brady Bowl or something like that. It's money. It's just a tradition that we've been getting fleeced by these guys for 70 years. Doesn't make any sense to me. Eventually, you stand up to the bully and say, stop stealing my lunch money.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. With the 2010 Bowl Championship Series just days behind us, there's a good deal of debate about college football's answer to crowning a national champion. The BCS has been described as the only answer by its proponents, but today's guest, Dan Wetzel, believes the BCS is more like a cartel that dictates how the sport operates in order to control the many millions of dollars generated by BCS games. Mr. Wetzel makes his case in the new book, Death to the BCS, the definitive case against the Bowl Championship Series, which he co-authored with sports writers Josh Peter and Jeff Passan. Mr. Wetzel is an award-winning national columnist for Yahoo Sports, the most read sports site on the web. He is the co-author of several other books, including the New York Times bestseller, Resilience, Faith, Focus, Triumph, written with former NBA star and kidney transplant survivor Alonzo Mourning, and Glory Road, we all remember that, about the 1966 Texas Western Miners, who were the first team to start five black players in the NCAA title game. Glory Road was a New York Times Editor's Choice and a Quill Award finalist and was adapted into a Disney movie of the same name. Mr. Wetzel has been featured in the Best American Sports Writing Anthology four times and has been called America's Best Sports Writer by Salon.com. He lives in Michigan, and he joins us today by phone. Dan Wetzel, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks for having me on, Bob. I really appreciate it.
Well, I know we're here to talk about Death to the BCS, but before we get to that, I just want to say what a great job you did with Glory Road. I just thought it was a fine book, a great movie. I must say that I did read in one of the reviews that the movie, as so many movies do, kind of took off from the reality of your book. How does an author deal with that when all of a sudden you're looking at something up on the screen that bears a slight resemblance to what you wrote, maybe more than slight, but not exactly the way the story unfolded?
Well, I think it was harder for me because I knew the players and the coaches, the coach, Don Haskins, who I wrote the book with, and it's their story. I mean, when you're writing a story like that, it's not your story. They did it. So I wanted it to be as accurate and as positive for them. And,
sure.
And the one part that Haskins had a problem with was, if you remember the movie, he waits in the movie till the final game to play five black players at the same time, and that isn't what happened. He started the whole year because he said, I don't care, I'm playing my five best players. So that hurt him a little bit. But for the most part, and that's really the only part that would bother me. It's not my story, it's theirs. So he wants to be portrayed a certain way, and he made a courageous decision at that time and really limited his career. I mean, you think about now, if a 36-year-old coach at a school like UTEP won the national basketball, national title, he could choose any job he wanted. Don Haskins never got that opportunity because he was seen as the coach of the black team, and he knew that going in. So he risked his career. He had a great life, but he risked his career at the time with four kids and not a lot of money being made to do the right thing.
Right. Well, again, it's a great reminder for our listeners if they're looking for a good book, Glory Road. If you haven't seen the movie, grab a copy of that. Just remember Dan's point about how it really unfolded. So let's talk about the BCS. You've written a great book here. As I told you before we went on the air, I talked to many people who are not necessarily huge sports fans, don't follow sports every day, and many people have picked up your book just because of all of the focus on the BCS. There was a day when we had those traditional bowls. I'm a Midwestern kid. I grew up waiting for the Rose Bowl every year, whether it was the title game or not. As far as I was concerned, there was only one football game, and that was the Big Ten and the Pac-10 playing in the Rose Bowl, and I'm sure the folks down south at the SEC thought similarly about their bowls, the orange, the cotton, the sugar. So what's wrong with those days? What was so wrong with those days that we needed to come to this point where we create a BCS?
Yeah, it's kind of the issue. I mean, I think if you stuck with the old way and said we're not trying to crown a champion, it'd be one thing. There's a simplicity to the argument if you just simply said we can't do it. There's too many teams. We're not inspired to do it. That's fine. You know, then you have your argument. What happened was ESPN nationalized the game. So I'm sure when you were growing up in the Midwest, you didn't get to see teams all over the country. You might have tuned in to see USC for the first time. Now you can see USC 7 or 8 times.
Right.
And you can see all the way to Boise State 7 or 8 times. So you can see everybody. And that's created the debate of who really is number one. And the idea of just a poll at the end just wasn't satisfactory to fans. And at the same time, the bowl industry realized quite smartly that this was an opportunity to expand their reach. They went from being what was essentially exhibition football games. They were exhibition games. Their stats didn't even count for a long time. And went from just running an exhibition game to administering the postseason of college football. And that's the key point of where we're at and why there's such resistance to the system, is because college football does not operate its postseason. The NFL playoffs that are going on are wholly owned by the NFL. They take all the money, all the TV revenue, all the way down to the popcorn sales. The NBA playoffs are run by the NBA. The NCAA basketball tournament is run by the NCAA. College football's postseason is outsourced to bowl directors. The championship game on Monday was run by the Fiesta Bowl. Those are a third-party group, and nothing to do with a college. It wasn't the university. It wasn't Arizona State or anything hosting it. It was a group, and they were going to take the profits off of that. And in traditional years where you double host like that, there's $10, $12 million in profit to be taken. You have a CEO of that game making $600,000-plus a year to run it. So it's a big business getting a foothold on running a major American sports postseason, and it's the only American sport that does this. It's really the only business I can think of that would ever outsource its most profitable and important product. But because of that, because there's people making big money on this, there's going to be strong, strong resistance, lobbying, and entrenchment to any kind of change that might loosen that grip. That's the key element I think you can take from our book.
But I think one of the arguments you're making is that if you loosen that grip, you send a good portion of those millions and millions of dollars back to the universities playing in those games and not into the pockets of these bowl executives and these organizations that have sprung up in recent years. So I guess what I'm having a tough time figuring out is, why wouldn't university presidents, and I'm not talking about university presidents like Boise State's, because of course we're a non-automatic qualifier, and I want you to explain that later, but why wouldn't even the presidents of the automatic qualifying conferences figure this out and say, you know what, there's a lot of money leaving the table here. Why wouldn't conference commissioners figure that out? That's what's so difficult for me to understand.
It's the $1 million, the $100 million question. And the reasons are myriad. I mean, you have basically a system that's very entrenched. It would take a tremendous amount of work to break it. If you consider that two and a half years ago, Mike Slive, the commissioner of the Southeastern Conference, John Swofford, the commissioner of the Atlantic Coast Conference, two of the big, huge conferences. Mike Slive's probably, you know, no one's bigger than the SEC, right? Their presidents, University of Florida, Florida State, Georgia, LSU, I mean, big-time schools. They wanted to expand the postseason to a plus one, a four-team playoff, still using bowl games, and they couldn't do it. They could not muster enough support to make that happen. That's how entrenched it is. So you have an individual athletic director somewhere or president somewhere or even one or, you know, four or five conferences saying, wait a minute, there's a better way here. They haven't been able to get this thing going. There's nobody in charge of college football. There's no Roger Goodell of the NFL to sit there and say, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense for the whole. Let's do this. You know, one of the questions I pose to these guys is, you take a bowl game. Let's cut out the BCS games, but you take like the Chick-fil-A bowl game, makes about $12 million in revenue. It only pays out about $5 million in revenue. So the schools get $5 million. Each school, the two conferences split $5 million. They have to pay their own expenses, things like that. The bowl game takes 60% of the profits right off the top and makes a tremendous amount of money. Why not just have the ACC and the SEC operate their own game and stage it in Atlanta, cut out the middleman? They know how to run a football game, keep all the money. And that's something that they look at and go, you know, that's a good idea, but it just hasn't been conceived. It's just, this is the Coke machine that's hard to push over. And that's one of the issues. So there's a lot of money on the table. Everyone admits it. Not everyone cares. People have different issues. Some people, a lot of university presidents don't get intimately involved in athletics. It's complicated. They don't want to mess with it. They're nervous about upsetting a football coach who gets fired. You know, there's just so many different reasons, but the main thing is just really a lack of leadership and a lack of shared vision of where college football could go, the health of the entire sport.
And when it comes to how many millions of dollars are lost to universities, you point out the ticket requirements. I have some personal firsthand knowledge of what those are all about. And UConn and Virginia Tech, I think, were at least two recent examples, weren't they, of just what happens to teams when they make that big move?
Yeah, well, what you hear about when it comes to the bowl industry, and what we tried to show in the book, is that it's not the BCS is not a highly profitable thing, because what they sell it on is, oh, it's big bucks, the big money bowl game. You're going to make $19 million for playing in the championship game. Well, that's not really the fact. What they forget is that schools have to pay all their own expenses. They have to send their teams to a bowl game for 8 nights. They have to send their band for 8 nights. They send traveling parties. They pay for all of that. Ohio State spent just under $2 million going to the Rose Bowl last year when they went. So the expenses are enormous going. You have to pay your own way. You also have to buy a certain number of tickets for any bowl game, even the small ones. 10,000, 15,000, 17,500. In the case of these BCS games that don't normally sell out, the average ticket could be $200. So we've had UConn this year, the estimate, we don't know what the final figure would be, but the estimate is they lost $2.5 million on unsold seats at the Fiesta Bowl. Virginia Tech and the ACC lost $1.77 million on the 09 Orange Bowl. Ohio State lost $1 million on the 09 Fiesta Bowl. These games, that's a huge money drain. Now, you sit there and say, well, yeah, but they got $19 million, so maybe they spent $3 or $4 million going the game, they still got $15 million. That's not how it works, because teams are losing, spending $1 million or $1.5 million going to the Little Caesars Bowl and the Beef O'Brady Bowl, and they're only getting a payout of $300,000. So to cover the lower teams, the lower bowls in a conference, conferences will pool all the money and try to cover all costs and make it so everybody breaks even on the bowl business. So instead of this big money bowls, what you have are teams either losing or breaking even on cash. And it's a total different financial model if you look at the facts of the case than what gets trotted out on television. That's the heart of our book, was let's follow the money and find out, why do we have the BCS? What's the real reason? It's not what we talk about, the academics. It's not the sanctity of the Beef O'Brady Bowl or something like that. It's money. This is America. Let's not kid ourselves. So we Freedom of Information Act all these contracts and looked at the tax records of the nonprofit BCS games and all the different things and said, you know, let's follow the money and here's the money. So the bowl business is very, very different than how it's often portrayed.
Well, let's look at the decision-making structure of this BCS system. Help us understand the difference between what we hear in the news all the time, the automatic qualifying conference, the non-automatic qualifying conference, and how did this get set up?
Well, you have six conferences that are the automatic qualifiers, and they're the Big Ten, Pac-10, Big 12, SEC, ACC, and the Big East, and they have essentially the control of the system. The leagues like the WAC or the Mountain West do not. There's five non-automatic qualifying teams, and then the University of Notre Dame has equal voting power, although no one ever votes, so they never really have a vote. But it's set up in the illusion of this democracy, but the truth is really the Big Ten has the most sway over everything. They're the biggest obstacle to kind of progress in any kind of reform. But those leagues have, you win your league, doesn't matter what your rank, you're going to get to go to a BCS bowl game, which does pay more money and gets more exposure. Obviously, Boise State got more money and more exposure playing in the Fiesta Bowl twice than they did playing in the Mako Bowl this time. So University of Connecticut was unranked this year. They finished the season with five losses, yet they got to go play in the Fiesta Bowl because they're a member of the Big East Conference, where Boise State is one field goal away from, you know, a perfect season, a far more popular team nationally, a far bigger television draw nationally. And they would have traveled more fans to the Fiesta Bowl than UConn, but they're left on the outside because it's set up so that certain leagues have a distinct advantage. Now, sometimes that distinct advantage makes sense. I don't think anyone's looking at the SEC and saying, boy, your champion is probably not going to be worthy. But at other times you say, well, why do we have these distinct? Why are these distinctions needed at all? Why not just take the top 10 teams and slot them into the BCS?
That seems to be the easiest approach. But getting back to a point you just made about the vote, you're right, of course. There is no vote taken, at least generally speaking, there's not. But that doesn't mean they don't decide. And when it comes to the decisions, I understand anyway, I've never been to one of these meetings, that oftentimes what happens is that the automatic qualifying conferences will call a meeting and ask the non-automatic qualifying conference members to leave the room, and then they'll have their final BCS discussion when they really do make the decisions.
That's happened before, yeah. People have been asked to leave the room. I mean, they know what the vote's going to be. And again, I mean, 2 years ago when they had one of these meetings and the SEC and the ACC pushed for change, And I you can't stress how important that was, significant that was, because these were, you know, the power conferences were splitting up and arguing. But even then, it got blocked. The Big Ten, Pac-10, Big 12, and Big East were going to block it, and that had been determined. How, when, no one knows. But it was. And those four weren't going to go against it. And if you look at the Big East Conference, you want to know why UConn gets in? Well, that's because that's how you win your favor. I mean, to me, the Big East Conference is every bit as perilous of a shape in the long term as the Mountain West is. It could very easily slip out of that because it does not have the traditional power football teams like the other major conferences do. It's one thing for the Big Ten to feel secure that they'll always be a major force in college football. It makes sense. They have Ohio State and Michigan and Wisconsin. Through the Big East, you don't have those kind of programs. It's very, very political to keep your power on them.
You're listening to Dan Wetzel. He's one of the authors of the book Death to the BCS, The Definitive Case Against the Bowl Championship Series. Dan, let's talk for a moment about the BCS ranking system. As I remember it, somewhere along mid-season, the BCS starts announcing its rankings. Is that correct?
They wait until mid-October.
Yeah, mid-October. So at that point, this ranking is based on three different rankings, really. Explain, if you could, those three rankings and bring us all the way up to the point where this season somebody goofed up and there was a little glitch in the rankings that had to be corrected, but it uncovers one of the flaws with the system, I guess.
Right, one we predicted would occur.
Right.
There's three elements to the BCS formula. There are two human polls. The coaches poll, and then something called Harris poll, which replaced the AP poll because the sports writers, the traditional AP poll, the sports writers said, we don't want to be a part of this. This is a sham. We're not going to be involved. So they had to find another poll. So they got a bunch of guys who are basically retired athletic directors, retired referees, former players or whatever. Now, using polling to determine a championship matchup is incredibly dubious. And you'll have professors on your campus who can explain this better than I. But there's all sorts of logical theorems that argue this is completely irrational. The most notable view is something called Arrow's Impossibility Theorem. And you may want to clear about 5 days to understand this thing, but the basic concept is this doesn't work. Polling is ridiculous. There's all sorts of stagnation. You don't have people. And then you have these groups that don't pay attention to the season. They're not very dialed in. And we saw it in a number of ways. Coaches will admit all they do is watch game film of their team and their next opponent. They don't even know what the scores are. They have their secretaries fill them out, whatever. You have this Harris poll group that is easily swayed by ridiculous things. Wisconsin this year ran, you know, you could argue whether they ran it up on purpose or not, but they scored 83 points in a football game against Indiana and increased their vote total. So things like running up the score are highly appreciated by the voters who go for these kind of glossy numbers. And there's also the problem with releasing your rankings in the middle of the season because it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. The best thing to do is just have one poll at the end, even if you were going to do polls. All right, now you have the third element, the computer formula, which is the most widely criticized, and for good reason. It's currently under protest by actual analytic mathematicians across America for not being mathematically sound. So the computer formula is not mathematically sound. I don't know what else to argue on that. But the issue is, and the reasons for this will be, we can debate, but the BCS commissioner said they don't want to include margin of victory in the computer. So the computer formulas are not allowed to use margin of victory. Well, this is a very small sample and a very, very small sample size. You have 12 games. You have 120 teams. So mathematically, it's almost impossible to come up with any kind of rational ranking system on this. You might be able to do it in baseball, where you have a smaller group of teams, tons of games. College football, very different. Disparate schedules, all of that. The two most important factors to consider on a football ranking would be when you want to know what happened in the game, you say, who won? Boise State won. By how much? Oh, we won 70-3. Ah, that's impressive. Oh, we won 3-2. Oh, boy, what happened, right? The second most important piece of data is the score. Took it out. And what they're trying to do, they argue, is, well, we're promoting sportsmanship. We're trying to not have people run up the score. Sportsmanship may be a fine ethical concept, but it is not a math concept. You cannot apply ethics to a math problem. Hence, you have an unmathematically sound system. Now, here's the other rub. So we have unmathematically sound system. We have polling that's under huge questions. But here's another part. The computer formulas, the six ranking guys, five of them declare their formula proprietary information. They refuse to share the system with anyone, including the BCS. So the BCS doesn't actually even know what the formulas are doing or whether these guys are even calculating them. Nobody knows how good the formula is because nobody knows what it is. And there's only one that's out there on the public. Now, this year, twice in the same season, including the final poll, the one public guy who, God bless him, hands out his formula to all the world, well, the guys on the internet check to see whether it's accurate. They run the numbers themselves on how he would do it. Twice this year, including the final poll, they found he had made a mistake in data entry, and the computer formula was wrong, and it coincidentally affected Boise State standing.
Right. Which makes you, of course, wonder, what are the other five guys doing? Why are they right so often?
We don't know what the other five are doing. Are they making mistakes? We don't know. Not only do you and I not know, the BCS doesn't know. So, you know, what kind of, I don't even think I need an explanation. Nobody knows what the formula is. Nobody knows what the rankings are accurate. No one knows if the data is accurate. We just go with it. This is not an acceptable system to come up with this. I mean, that's just the problems in determining your championship game. They're flying blind on this.
So let's talk about your playoff system, and we don't have a lot of time, but if you could just kind of summarize, how would this playoff system work after the regular season?
We're in favor of almost any playoff system, so anything's better than what we have, whether it's 4, 6 teams, 8, whatever. Intellectually, I think where we got to the 16-team playoffs, if you take it to its conclusion, this is really the only intellectually sound one, although we'd be willing to compromise. But you take the champion of all 11 conferences, including the Sun Belt, the WAC, whatever, it would have created great stability. You wouldn't have all the moving around of the leagues that we've had. You put them in the tournament. You have five at-large teams. You seed those. Now you say, why would we put the Sun Belt in there, the teams of North Texas or Troy? They're not very good. They're not the 16th best team in the country. That's true. Their reason to be in there is to reward the 1, the 2, the 3 seed, the teams that have had exceptional seasons, undefeated Auburn, undefeated Oregon, with a easy first-round game, the de facto bye. So the Troy or the Florida International does not have a chance to win the championship, but they help keep the great value on the regular season, rewards teams to go to a regular season. If you just took 8 teams or 16 teams, 1 through 16 in the ranking, played each other on a neutral field, there's no difference between being number one and number 16. So you need to do something to make number one work.
And that's what happens in basketball, isn't it?
Yes, they give them an easier first-round game. Now, we would also add value to the regular season. It's the same way that the NFL does it, so the Seahawks are in the thing. It's the same way college Division I, AA, 2, 3, all those do it. We would also play home games, cut the bowl games out. There's no need to have these guys moving in on the profits. Put games back on the great on-campus environments you have in college football, and you, again, reward teams for getting a high seed. Now Auburn or Oregon or TCU or Boise could host the game, and it would be great value to getting to be a top eight seed or a top four seed, top two. There's huge value in that. And now you've made the regular season actually matter more. The TV executives say under this plan, regular season interest and television ratings would go through the roof. The playoff would generate unbelievable ratings and money, all of that. You wouldn't be hurting college football. You'd be helping college football. Play the thing out.
Would you then incorporate those traditional bowls into that playoff system? What happens to them?
I wouldn't. I would maybe keep the Rose Bowl and play the title game there. If you want to rotate with a couple of them for the title game, keep it neutral, that's fine. But I would not. I don't see the value in outsourcing your most profitable product. No one else does it.
Right.
It's just a tradition that we've been getting fleeced by these guys for 70 years. We need to keep getting fleeced.
Yeah.
Doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah.
Okay. Eventually you stand up to the bully and you say, stop stealing my lunch money. Now's the time to do that. Now, the bowl games would not go out of business. If you look at the business of bowl games, there's tremendous amount of money being made by the bowls. They already have huge profit margins. B, they're, as we discussed earlier, they're subsidized by the schools. Tickets, buying empty seats, paying all costs. Now, the playoff would generate so much more money to the overall system, schools would actually have more money to subsidize the bowl games even more. It wouldn't matter so much how much the bowls are paying out because you would have four times as much revenue coming in the playoff. So I happen to like bowl games, and I don't have a problem when 2 7-5 teams play in a game. So it's great for those kids. It's fun. It's exciting. It's good for the communities that are around the country. Those games would not go out of business. So one of the big fallacies that they create is it's either playoff or bowls. That's not the proper question. It should be playoffs and bowls.
Does it strike you as odd that the NCAA, which gets about 85% of its budget from the basketball tournament, hasn't figured out a way to get into this discussion? I mean, obviously it doesn't want to get into this discussion, but I can't imagine why the NCAA is sitting on the sidelines.
It's puzzling as much now as 30, 40 years ago. There was a time in college basketball where the National Invitation Tournament, the NIT, was bigger than the NCAA. There was no actually NCAA tournament, and then the NIT ran the show. The NIT is much like a bowl game. It's a group of private outside group, or it might be not, it might have been nonprofit, but same thing. And they ran their tournament out of Madison Square Garden. They invited. They had the biggest tournament going. 1939, the NCAA said, no, we should run our own. Now, it took a couple decades for the NCAA basketball tournament to be bigger than the NIT tournament. But it happened. The NCAA competed, and they won it over. And by the time John Wooden was winning all his titles or Glory Road was going on, NCAA tournament was bigger. I don't know why college football didn't do that in the 60s and 50s when it would be easier. Now there's so much money getting spent to try to fight this thing, advertising, lobbying, PR people, law firms, everything. It's a little bit harder to do now. But the fact NCAA does not control its most profitable and important product, college football postseason, is absolutely mind-boggling to anybody who knows anything about business.
Dan, we've run out of time. Thank you so much to our listeners. All I can tell you from reading this book is that we've scratched the surface. Get out there and get a copy of it. It's Death to the BCS, the definitive case against the Bowl Championship Series. Thanks for joining us today on Reader's Corner, Dan.
Thank you, Bob. Really appreciate it.
Next week, Rebecca Skloot, author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week on Reader's Corner as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world.